afternoon. Please be seated. Our first case this afternoon is case number 55897. Robert Dillon Framing Inc. versus Cannon Villas Apartment Corporation. I think I'm familiar with these attorneys. Let's see. Oh, that's Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Posenberg.
Yes, sir.
I'm familiar with both of them. Mr. Eisenberg, you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
A little levity never hurts.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing with Leonard Fink on behalf of the appellant, and I'm going to attempt to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves several issues, but the Court's order for oral argument identified some issues that you wanted us to address, so I'll get to that order right off the bat here. And the first question the Court asked was whether why the prime contract in this case is irrelevant to Robert Dillon Framing's contract, even though Robert Dillon Framing was not a party to the prime contract. And that question can be answered by reference to the fact that the subcontract referred to contract documents, and the Court's order recognizes that the phrase contract documents could be ambiguous in this context. And it was ambiguous. It was a defined term in capital letters, but there was no definition. So the only place that these parties could possibly look for the definition of contract documents was the prime contract. Now, in this Court's White Main case, the Court dealt with two different contracts entered into by different parties, and the Court said that those two contracts should be harmonized and construed together if three requirements are satisfied. They have to deal with the same subject matter, they have to be executed contemporaneously, and the Court said that could be up to a few months, and at least one of the contracts has to refer to the other. All three of those requirements are satisfied here. These two contracts clearly dealt with the same subject. They were executed within a month of each other, and the prime contract referred to the subcontract and vice versa. In fact, the prime contract required the general contractor to include in the subcontract a provision requiring subcontractors to comply with the contract documents. And the general contractor complied with that and included in the subcontract that very provision. So without any other place to look for the definition of contract documents, you almost have to look to the prime contract, and that's why we contend, based on the White Main case and the facts of this case, that you really can't do anything else other than harmonize the two contracts and construe them together. Now, the owner here, which was an affiliated company with the general contractor, tried to build a wall. In the prime contract, the owner included a provision that said, nothing in this contract document shall be construed to create any relationship whatsoever, to create any relationship of any kind with the subcontractor. So the owner tried to build a wall to make sure that if anything happened with the subcontractor, the sub would not be able to sue the owner. Instead, the sub would have to sue the general contractor. But instead of erecting a wall, it really was just a one-way wall, where the owner wanted it to protect the owner in case the sub had any claim, but the owner wanted to be able to sue the subcontractor and assert a relationship with the subcontractor, even though the prime contract said that there would be no relationship of any kind. We believe that these contract documents and the case law from around the country suggests that when you have an owner, a general contractor, and subcontractors, that the parties carefully craft that relationship. And when they have a provision in the prime contract that precludes any contractual relationship between the owner and the subcontractor, that's absolute. The owner has a clear remedy here, and an easy remedy. The owner can sue the party with whom the owner entered into a contract, and that's the general contractor. But because the owner and the general contractor in this case were related entities within the Olenikoff Empire, obviously the owner didn't want to sue the general contractor because basically Mr. Olenikoff would be suing himself. So that didn't happen.
So what do you do with paragraph 17 of the subcontract?
Is that the assignment paragraph?
That's its title.
That's its title, and that's one of our points, is that it's an assignment paragraph. And when you read it, it has two sentences. The first sentence would seem to suggest that there's a relationship between the owner and the subcontractor.
Shall I move to the benefit?
But if you read it, first of all, the general rule, it has to be construed against the drafter if there's any ambiguity. And it suggests that it is ambiguous. It's buried within a paragraph dealing with assignments. And so we contend that it should deal with assignments. What happens if there's an assignment by the subcontractor to another subcontractor? What happens if there's an assignment from the owner to another owner, just like there was here, from the original Owen residential to Canyon Villas? And in that context, we think it should be interpreted against the drafter in such a way that it deals with the assignment and the benefits of whatever assignment there might be. Third-party beneficiary law requires a provision to be clear and unambiguous. And the cases that we've cited in our brief that have dealt with this have said that in the owner-contractor, subcontractor scenario, the owner is not a third-party beneficiary of the subcontract. The owner is an incidental beneficiary, because the general contractor owes the owner the duty to build the building. The general contractor uses subcontractors in order to perform its obligation to the owner. But if the subcontractors don't perform, it's the general contractor who maybe has to go get another subcontractor in order to fulfill its duty to the owner. So in that context, I think the best case is the Pierce case that we cited involving the hospital construction, where the court said that, no, it's the owner is an incidental beneficiary of that contract. The second question that the court asked us to address deals with the economic loss rule, and the court asks, what is the effect of Robert Dillon Framing's failure to raise the issue in its Rule 50A motion during trial? The economic loss rule was thoroughly vetted and thoroughly litigated throughout this whole case leading up to trial and at trial. The economic loss rule came as no surprise to anyone. The Rule 50A motion did not include, it was an oral motion made at the end of the plaintiff's case, did not include a discussion of the economic loss rule because at that time it couldn't have. At that time, the breach of contract claim was still in existence and still a viable claim. Under the breach of contract claim, the plaintiff could have received economic loss damages consisting of the cost of repair. So at the end of the plaintiff's case, it would have been impossible, really, for the defense to make a motion for a judgment as a matter of law in its favor on the economic loss rule because the breach of contract claim was still in existence. It wasn't until, number one, plaintiff's counsel made his closing argument, told the jury the only thing they're asking for is the cost of repair damages, and number two, the jury returned its verdict, a defense verdict, on the breach of contract claim, but a plaintiff's verdict on the breach of implied warranty claim. At that point, and only at that point, did the defense have a legitimate motion for a judgment as a matter of law based upon the economic loss rule.
Well, didn't your client make a Rule 50A motion on the contract claim? Thought they did. So assuming that they were optimistic that piece would be grounded, wouldn't they have then followed to make the follow-along 50A on the economic loss claim?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't remember whether the 50A motion...
You would know better than I, too. I'm not sure either.
But even if it did, the judge obviously ruled against him. As I recall, a breach of express warranty claim was dismissed. He made a Rule 50 motion. I think the 50A motion was based on the argument that the claim for a breach of the implied warranty was no good because there was a breach of contract claim. And when you have a breach of contract claim, which sets forth the standard of conduct,
it eclipses the implied claim.
Yeah, you don't need the implied warranty claim. So in any event, for that reason, we believe that the Rule 50A motion at trial did not have to include the economic loss argument. Additionally, the post-trial motion was not just a Rule 50B motion for judgment as a matter of law. It also included a motion to alter or amend the judgment. And I'm unaware of any rule that says that if you don't include a ground in a 50A motion during trial, you're precluded from raising it as a motion to alter or amend the judgment after trial. And I wanted to reserve 5 minutes, but I do want to touch on the economic loss rule a little bit more just to point out to the court that the economic loss rule, we are contending, applies in this situation because the breach of implied warranty case should be considered a tort. And the nutshell of that argument is that contract remedies provide for the expectations of the parties and the standard of conduct that they have to comply with. Tort remedies provide for a different standard of conduct that's basically a reasonableness standard of contract. And what the jury was instructed in this case on the breach of implied warranty claim was that Robert Dillon Framing had to exercise reasonably skillful performance, and they had to perform work as a reasonable contractor would in the circumstances. That reasonableness standard is a tort concept. It didn't arise out of this contract. It was implied by law, and we believe it should be treated as a tort for purposes of the economic loss rule. The other two issues that the court identified in its order are, as I read them, issues relating to the cross-appeal here, so I won't address them now unless the court has a question.
Any questions for Mr. Eisenberg? Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Posenberg?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Sherry. May it please the court. Dan Posenberg for Canyon Villas. Let me try to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal on my cross-appeal. Let me address the issues in the same order that Mr. Eisenberg did. I think the standing issue, their standing argument, has, for my taste, too many moving parts. If you look at page 14 of their brief, or page 11 of their brief, there are five different things that you have to look at. You look at this part of the prime contract, this part of the subcontract, you go back and forth. I think it's very easy. I think under paragraph 8, I don't even have to go, Justice Pickering, to paragraph 17. I think even under subparagraph 8, at least four times, it mentions owner. This contract between the prime contractor and the subcontractor, Robert Dillon Framing, repeatedly gives rights to the owner. And that is why there is standing in this case. If I do go to paragraph 17, though, I can't agree with RDF's argument about what that means. Yes, it has two paragraphs. They say the expansive rights of the owner are buried in paragraph 17. Well, if they are, they're buried right at the top of paragraph 17, because what it's basically saying is that this agreement inures to the benefit of the contractor and the owner and all successors, assigns, and others claiming under or through them. So what it's saying as assignments is the contractor, the owner, any assignee, anybody, broad rights under this paragraph. However, the contractor does not have the right to the subcontractor does not have the right to sub this out. They have to perform. So we went under that. We went under 17. We went under 8. They talk about how they have, it refers to they have to conform with the prime contract. What it says is that the work has to be in conformance with the contract documents. The work here, the work to be done, the framing and the windows and the sliding doors. And when it says contract documents, it is just a bridge too far to say that they must get the definition for contract documents from the general contract. And the reason for that is what contract documents generally means is what are the documents that constitute the contract between these contracting parties. And in the prime contract, you see that. It has a paragraph that says the contract documents are this contract, the conditions, the plans, etc. To say that the contract documents in the subcontract is defined in the prime contract, honestly, doesn't make a lot of sense, which is why I suspect the court asked that question. RDF comes up here and talks about Weathermane, and it's an interesting argument, but they only cite Weathermane as a CF on page 17. This is an argument that isn't really developed in their brief about how to read contracts together.
Excuse me? Weathermane.
Weathermane, thank you. I'm reading my own handwriting rather than the brief. That's a mistake.
The point is that multiple contracts comprise this contract. That's their argument, that multiple writings comprise the contract with the subcontractor and entitles them to rely on contract documents, capital C, capital D, right?
Well, their argument, I think there's two different arguments that they're making, but the capital C, capital D means that it must be defined somewhere. It's not defined in our document. We should look at somebody else's document. But if that were the case, then the contract documents between the contractor and the subcontractor would be the contract between the owner and the general contractor, and in which case Robert Dillon Framing would have the obligation to build the entire project. And that wouldn't make sense. They say that our remedy, Canyon Villas, or Olin, the original Olin owner, the remedy was to sue Olin Development, the affiliated company that was the general contractor. Well, you know, we raised in the district court that this really is a standing issue. If the only person who can sue the subcontractor is the general contractor, Olin Development, then let's substitute in Olin Development. Olin Development, our affiliated corporation, would have no problems at all having standing here. Judge Johnston didn't think that was necessary because we did have standing, and I think it's an easy standing argument for us. They raised the Pierce case, and
I may have given Pierce short shrift in the appellate briefing. I mentioned it two times. Here's the briefing on Pierce in the district court. We did talk about that a lot. But I think the distinction between this case and Pierce, I think there are two. One, in Pierce, it said that it actually incorporated the general contract and said, this, we incorporate the terms of the general contract and the conditions to the general contract. This doesn't say that. And in Pierce, there wasn't the express grant of right to the owner that we have here in paragraph 8 and paragraph 9 and paragraph 17. So I don't think we're there.
Mr. Posner, can I ask you about the implied warranty? Is it a tort or is it a contract? Is it a cause of action?
Can I say it depends?
Can you hear punitive damages for breach of an implied warranty?
Well, that's a good question. That's why I say I think it depends. And if you look at all the cases, and some of them are breach of merchantability cases, and there is a punitive damage case that they cite. I think and there are statute of limitations cases. I think it really depends why you are suing under the implied warranty. Under their Trans Gulf case, the case that they cite in the brief, that court, and it's probably the only case that really goes their way, but it's distinguishable too. That court said, we will only find an implied warranty cause of action as a tort cause of action if there's a compelling need to do so. And they couldn't bring the contract action in that case because the contract expressly disclaimed an implied warranty. So they were trying to make a tort. So I think in this case, I think for generally it is a contractual claim. Sometimes it can be tort. I think in this case it is a contractual claim because it all has to do with the performance of the contract. And I think clearly we tried the case that way. Remember, at trial, what we said is, and I'm not sure it's the most precise statement of the law, we said, well, a contract claim is when you don't perform under the contract at all, and an implied warranty claim is when you perform, but you don't do a good job. I think we could have brought it all under the contract claim. I think we gave the jury a way to distinguish between these two claims, and obviously they had performed, and I would say not well, when I can justify that by the jury's verdict. So the jury necessarily, hearing all of that, came down with a determination under warranty. But I think the way
this court implied in Callaway that we would accept that concept, implied warranty as a tort?
I think
has not this court done so.
Well, there's a line in Callaway that does look like that it is a tort that is different from negligence and from strict liability. So the economic loss doctrine, I don't think, would apply. And that goes to my original remark, Justice Gibbons. I think it depends whether it's contractual or tort. I don't think it's negligence. I don't think the economic loss doctrine applies. But most compellingly, I don't think they raised this issue in the district court. They say they made a 50A motion, but really, you know, they didn't make a 50A motion that said we cannot recover economic loss damages under implied warranty. If they had raised that issue, we would have tried the case differently. We wouldn't have gone under that artificial distinction as to what is contract and what is negligence.
Could you comment on Mr. Eisenberg's argument with respect to that, though, that they had no reason to bring a 50A motion on that point until the jury rendered its...
No, that's not true. They hadn't thought of it before that. As we tried the case, there's a contract claim and an implied warranty claim. I don't think anybody thought the jury was going to come down with one and not the other. And because of that, I don't think they raised the 50A motion. And if they had raised the 50A motion and said, look, you can't recover all these damages under warranty, you can only recover it under contract, we would have said, and I know we would have said, because I've talked to the trial lawyers right after the trial, and I raised this issue in the district court, we wouldn't have tried the implied warranty claim. We would have just gone with contract and said that the contract expressly, and it does expressly, say that they have to perform, with reasonable workmanship. And so we have a contractual clause that allows us to bring that. We'd have tried this case differently. And 50A, the reason that you have the obligation under 50A to allow a party to be fully heard is because you can remedy situations, and we could have remedied this situation. It really doesn't make sense for them to say, well, there was no reason to say you couldn't recover it under one claim. There was no reason for them to make a 50A motion saying that I couldn't recover economic loss damages under warranty when I could recover it under contract. And then later, after the trial, say, oh, wait, you only won under one of the two things. It's a situation that could have been resolved. Now, they come in and say, well, they don't have to make a 50A motion under 59E. Well, you know, that I love the AA Primo case, but this carries that beyond anything that I can see. Because what they're saying is, if you make a 59E motion to amend the judgment to say the plaintiff gets nothing, that's not a 50A motion, or 50B motion, rather. So I clearly do not think the issue was preserved. So the court shouldn't address it. Let me in my...
What do you say to Mr. Eisenberg's remarks, though, and the record bears him out, that certainly other parties were arguing economic loss from start to finish, or start to exit of those parties?
Right. I used to teach a seminar on how to preserve issues, and I said there are three steps. How do you preserve an issue? You've got to think of the issue, you've got to say the issue, and you have to have the district judge rule on the issue. Here, of course, I contend they didn't think of it until after trial, that the warranty claim doesn't get it.
But he says he was joining in...
Joining in motions that were not decided.
Okay.
They joined in a summary judgment motion that went to joint and several liability. Didn't go to whether they could recover. The ruling requested had nothing to do with economic loss. And they joined the motions in limine. The trial was continued. The party who made them settled. And when it was time for new motions in limine, they didn't make them. They have 14 reasons why they preserved the issue, all because they didn't do the one thing they had to do and make a 50A motion that would have affected the way we tried the case. The cross-appeal, let me see if I can do that very quickly. The cross-appeal has three issues. Number one, we should have gotten fees under the contract rather than just the offer of judgment, because the fees provision provided that the owner gets fees. That means we would get fees going all the way back rather than just back to the offer. Number two, paralegal fees. Judge Johnston, to simplify this case, thought the paralegal fees were unreasonable and excessive and denied them all. I don't think they're unreasonable. 1,900 hours over 5 years at, what, about $150 an hour? You know, part of my job every month is to bill clients. And part of me is shocked every month when I see the bills. But litigation is time, especially construction defect litigation, is time-consuming and costly, and these paralegals did a good job. Should you just decide, okay, give all the fees? I don't think this court likes to do that. I would remand and have the district court determine what fees to give. The next issue is costs. Here's what Judge Johnston did. At the hearing, plaintiffs proposed take all the costs and divide by the number of parties that were involved at the time of the cost and give that proportion. I think that's inappropriate. I think I've cited cases saying that that is the incorrect standard. I think what the court, district court, should have done is, if not give us all our fees, because that's the general rule, the non-settler pays the fees, I mean all our costs, the non-settler pays the costs, at least the court should have looked at our overwhelming evidence that demonstrated that particular costs were due to Robert Dillon framing. And I'd like to save the 55 seconds I have for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Eisenberg?
Thank you, Your Honor. I rarely object at an oral argument, but I am going to object to the court's consideration of Mr. Posenberg's evidence here about his discussions with counsel after the trial. That's not part of this record and should not be considered by the court, nor should the court consider the speculation that he's asking you to engage in regarding what attorneys thought of or didn't think of during the trial. You should go by the record here and only the record. He says that if we had done a better job of raising the issue, they would have altered their strategy. Well, what he says in his opening brief is the strategy they would have used is to abandon the breach of implied warranty claim and rely solely on the breach of contract claim. Well, the jury returned a defense verdict on the breach of contract claim. They must have had a reason for doing that. So he's asking you to believe that they would have abandoned the one claim that they won on, and they would have only gone on the claim that they lost on. And that just makes no sense. As far as paragraph 17, the assignment provision, we contend that that provision has to be construed in harmony with the provision in the prime contract that says there's no relationship of any kind between the owner and the subcontractor. The White Moon case, yes, I did use a CF signal before that, but what I cited that case for was exactly what it stands for, and that is related contracts have to be harmonized. And my expanded discussion of the White Moon case today is a result of the court's order where you asked, why is it that the prime contract applies here to Robert Dillon Framing, even though RDF was not a party in that contract? Counsel mentions that only development was denied involvement in here, that the judge found that they weren't, I forget exactly how he characterized it, weren't necessary. My recollection of what happened is that only development tried to intervene itself as a party in the case, but it was shortly before trial, and that the reason for the denial was because the trial was coming up, so they were just too late to do that. And then finally, I wanted to address the paralegal fee issue. The judge found that the amount of paralegal fees were 1,900 hours at $150 an hour was excessive in its time and its amount and the rate and the hourly rate. And counsel stands here and he says, well, I don't think it was excessive. Well, the judge did, and it was within the judge's discretion. And I would also point out that in the opening brief on the cross-appeal, Canyon Villas did not contend that the district court committed error by finding that the paralegal fees were excessive in the amount and the hourly rate. That's an issue that this court raised, but it really isn't an issue in the appeal here because Canyon Villas didn't raise it. Unless the court has any questions.
Any further questions to Mr. Eisenberg? Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Posner, you have about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue on the paralegal fees, I think, is clear, and it is uncomfortable to ask the court to just say the district court was wrong in finding the fees unreasonable. What I'm really doing is saying the district court erred as a matter of law in excluding all paralegal fees, and that's the situation I have here. And the remark about my discussions with the trial counsel, I'm not adding to the record. As I made clear, I presented all that in the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to Mr. Posner, Mr. Eisenberg, for your fine arguments this matter, your briefs this matter, stand submitted. Thank you.